Today, we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind: Sambar and Mapesh. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
To Straight No Chaser. This is radio from HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and my studio is absolutely full up today. We have three wonderful guests for the show. We'll be talking about cookbooks, about food trends, and this show will be all about policy, professionals, and the performance of the food industry in the 21st century. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Libby Summers, Catherine Alford, and Kathy Gunst, and you'll be hearing more about what they've been doing in just a second. This is Straight No Chaser on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick at 261 Moore Street, and brunch is being served. So in the studio, I have Kathy Gunst, who is not only a cookbook author and the author of a brand new book called Notes from a Maine Kitchen. She is also a host on WBUR's Here and Now as their resident restaurant, or what do you call yourself?
Resident chef.
Resident chef. Yeah, resident restaurant chef. I was going to say resident chef. We have Libby Summers, who is the author of The Whole Hog Cookbook, and she's going to tell us all about that. She even has a foreword by Paula Deen and a really beautiful photograph of herself all dressed up, making nice with her pigs.
Don't hold a foreword against me, Katie.
Yeah. Oh, no, I wouldn't. And we have Catherine Alford, who is the Test to Kitchen Director of Food Network, speaking of Paula Deen.
Absolutely.
So let's start with you, Kathy, since, you know, I sort of know you better. I've looked at your book for longer. It's Notes from a Maine Kitchen. And in the introduction, you say, I wanted to celebrate how evolved the culinary scene has become. And you're telling me that Maine is more than blueberries and lobster. Let me hear what's happened.
Yeah, way more, way more. Well, Portland, Maine, I mean, I won't say that it rivals Portland, Oregon, but it's pretty close. It's become a very sophisticated, pretty complex food city. The state is filled with incredible chefs right now, but maybe even more importantly, really interesting farmers. Every other person seems to be making cheese or bread or beer or some artisan product that they are so deeply proud of. So, you know, it's a major trend. We can talk about this later, but Maine is, it's a big deal there. And I mean, we have two or three James Beard award-winning chefs there. I spent some time. Notes from a Maine Kitchen is really about a journey. It's about a year in life. It starts in January and right. It ends in December. And it chronicles the food scene there. And part of my goal was to really talk about what the whole year is like in Maine. Most people know about it in July. They come and visit their kids in camp, or they come and eat lobster until they're so sick of it they can't look at anything red. So it's a much larger story from January fishing for smelts on the Cathance River.
Oh, I loved that, actually.
That's a fun story.
I should say that every sort of section is prefaced by a really nice essay about, you know, that particular month, like how you were feeling or what you were doing. And the smelt fishing one was really caught my eye because you went ice fishing.
Went ice fishing my first time. Sam Hayward, chef of 4th Street in Portland, one of those James Beard Award-winning chefs, took me and two of his buddies 2 miles up the frozen Cathance River on a bitter cold January day. And I was wearing 14 layers of clothing. Wow. I was ready for Arctic conditions. And we get into a hut, and there's a wood-burning stove, and the guy had preheated it for us.
Oh my God.
I stripped down to a t-shirt, and we started fishing for smelts. And within about an hour, we had over 100 fish. And they're these spectacular rainbow-colored fish, about 6 to 8 inches. And they smell like cucumber. And they taste like cucumber.
Why?
It's the there's something about these freshwater fish. They're, let's see if I can say this right, androminous. Oh my goodness, I'm going to blow it.
They spawn in
freshwater, and they live in salt water. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so they have this really interesting flavor. But in January, to be harvesting fresh food, we brought it back to Sam's kitchen. We coated them in Maine cornmeal and Maine sea salt and freshly ground pepper, heated up a cast iron skillet, cook them over really high heat for about 3 minutes. You cannot eat better food in January. Almost anywhere, I would say. So that's an example of one of the chapters. And then I take you through the calendar year with foraging and gardening. And I even write a little bit about parenting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's a lovely book. I've enjoyed it. And then, Libby, tell us a little bit about the Whole Hog Cookbook, because whole hog, nose-to-tail cooking, that is tout le rage right now.
Snout
definitely
to shitter,
very hot.
As my grandmother used to say.
Yeah.
Snout to shitter. Lula Mae was quite a character. I have to say first about Maine.
Yes.
Here's how much I love Maine cooking. My husband and I left Savannah, Georgia, December 31st one year, flew up to Maine to have a New Year's Eve dinner at Primo with Melissa Kelly. That's how much I love Maine, to leave fabulous weather to go freeze my butt off.
And it was worth it, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she's
Primo's
really
one of my
good.
Favorite
she's
restaurants
really
in the United States. Yeah. Love Maine.
So tell us about Whole Hog. What made you want to write a book that's like all about the whole pig?
Oh, it's just, well, it goes back.
And are you a butcher?
No, I'm not a butcher. Okay. I wish that I knew a lot more about butchery than
that
I do.
That can be arranged, you know.
Yeah, I would love to. My grandparents were hog farmers in Missouri, and it was just this, as everything starts out with these wonderful memories, and, you know, that's what brings us the love. And anyway, I wanted to write a book just kind of celebrating the pig and every last bit of it, but something that was really approachable. This is a fun, total fun pork for chicks, beautiful book with a lot of how-tos in it, but it's not intimidating in any way.
Not with titles like Lula Mae's. I just missed the page. Lula Mae's double cola braised pork shoulder.
Oh, Grandma Lula Mae, she'd be smoking a cigarette and stirring that stirring that sauce in there, cussing, hair changing color daily.
No, it's a gorgeous
love
book.
Love her.
Also, you have wonderful photos, very retro styling to them. They're hilarious.
Some of them,
I mean,
some
those
of them
are really
retro.
Cool.
Some of them, yeah.
I like that a lot.
Some of them are retro.
And so did you write this? I mean, it takes a long time to write a cookbook. So did you start working on this like years ago and then the trend caught up with you? Or did you spot a trend and think, oh, let me go with that?
Well, I wish I could say I had a long time to work on it. I think this book was done the fastest cookbook known to man.
That's impressive.
Thank you. It was. It was finished in about 11 weeks.
What?
Which was very... Can you believe that? I know. It's nuts. Financially, we had a big buy-in on the book, and it had to come out in 2011.
Jiminy.
So I took 11 weeks, and luckily what I do for a living is food styling and culinary producing, and, you know, so... And a lot of the recipes were already done. You know, when you pitch a book, you're giving them so many recipes to begin with.
Right.
So we just put it in hot, you know, high gear. I didn't shower for like 10 days straight, my husband tells me. I didn't have sex in those 10 days either. I just want you to know.
I am so glad to know that.
You don't.
Like, I feel better. I really do.
It was bad.
Well, let's take a short break and come right back with Libby Summers, Kathy Gunston, Catherine Alford on Straight with No Chaser. We'll be right back. This is Straight No Chaser on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm in the studio with Libby Summers, Kathy Gunst, and Catherine Alford. All three are cookbook authors, among many other hats that they wear in the culinary world. So the first question I have for all three of you is, how hard is it to write a cookbook? Because, you know, everybody who's made a recipe thinks, oh, I should write a cookbook. And then they get mired into writing a cookbook, or maybe they don't. But just how hard is it? What does it take? What do you have to have besides a concept?
You have to have a tolerance for eating the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. And everyone in your family has to have that too. So everyone does think it's very romantic and easy. But the minute you, like, you know, you're basically writing sets of instructions over and over. It's kind of like programming a VCR and writing something competent so people can do that. And that's not really very sexy.
Wow, but you just made it a bummer.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Well, that's what I'm coming from, the point of view of, like, to make it a good cookbook, there's a lot of technical things that are going in that very, very important behind the story. But the thing that it takes to actually do a really great cookbook is you have to be, and as both of these authors are, incredibly passionate about your subject and have a fresh point of view about it. Because, you know, there's a lot of cookbooks out there that are just, you know, the same old thing sort of reworked. And when they're passionate either about place or about an ingredient, then that becomes a unique story. And that's what makes cookbooks really pleasurable.
So what makes the cookbook successful in the end is really the voice of the author, in a way, isn't it?
I think it's the voice of the author and the voice and playfulness of the food too, because the food really represents that sort of voice and making it accessible and seducing someone into the kitchen.
I think it's also luck and time and place and trends. I mean, there, you know, every single time you open a website or walk into a bookstore, thank God there still are bookstores, there's just so many cookbooks. It's mind-blowing. But apparently it's one of the few areas of book sales that is steady right now. Mm-hmm. But I was going to answer passion. I was absolutely going to say, I generally spend 1 to 2.5 to 3 years working on a book, so you can't get bored. You have to stick with it, as opposed to 11 weeks, which blows me away.
And of course, I'm going to say, you know, with a team of people, which we do at Food Network, we'll do a book in 4 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very different structure. It's a very different structure.
Yeah, of course.
Structure.
Absolutely. And you did it in 11 weeks. Did you have assistance?
11 weeks. Oh, yes. We could have never.
So you had a whole test kitchen, and there were people working on testing the recipes the whole time.
And we were to the last second as we were shooting, you know, doing a third test on recipes. Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with having to love the same ingredient over and over and over. It took me a while to eat pork, I got to tell you, and I love it.
Yeah,
and I love
it. Because you got a lot. How many recipes are in your book?
120-ish.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. But I will say, I will speak to the voice of it, too. Like, one reason that I think that I know that how come my book, how much I love it so much, is because Rizzoli actually let me be, and I'll put this in quotation marks, air quotes for everyone out there, slightly irreverent. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of me. I'm more
is that
than
in your
I'm
press
more,
release.
Yes. David, okay, you can be slightly irreverent, Libby.
Tell us more about your sex life.
It might be mentioned in there. I'm not
quite
sure.
Forget about pig.
Right. But I think what Libby says is really important. I certainly, Downey's Books did my book. They're a main publisher, but they let me have my voice. One of the best compliments I'll get is from someone who reads it, who knows me and says, I just heard you on every page. And I thought, bingo, you know,
right.
That's what I want to hear. And then I want to hear, you made me so hungry.
Well,
those are your two goals of a cookbook.
And that's what the author is. I mean, someone who buys a cookbook really wants someone to take them into their world, almost like, you know, it's your grandmother, your friend, or whoever is teaching you how to cook. You really do
right.
have to. I always think that I want them to feel like we are standing right behind them in the kitchen and making it easy and fun and playful. Like, we've done all the work, so they can just have fun when they're cooking.
Isn't that the name of one of the cookbooks you've worked on, Making It Easy?
Yes, it is.
Oh, nice tie-in.
I did the publicity for it.
Yes.
So. Yeah, back in the day when I was still flacking, thank God. I don't
And you were awesome, my darling.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I appreciate that. Actually, those were books that I that really speak to. I mean, if you want to talk about making sure that you have the directions down, I did a lot of publicity for a lot of cookbooks, and the Food Network Kitchen's cookbooks were bar none the best ones in terms of like absolutely making that technique completely accessible and completely understandable and fun to play with. And you know, we did a lot of different authors, and believe me, other publishers are not as, or other cookbook authors are not necessarily. I mean, I want to just glance for a second into the world of testing your recipes.
Well, this is a
huge thing.
It doesn't
always happen.
You're right.
Yeah,
it
is a huge
thing. And it's
very
expensive. I mean, I really do feel for, you know, people say, oh, don't you want to write cookbooks, you know, like these two lovely ladies on your own? And I'm like, I love the fact that I have a team of incredibly talented people who, A, someone shops for me, someone does the dishes for it, and it's like, it is a collaborative thing. And
okay, now you're making me jealous.
Okay. Yeah. But it's great to have as many people sort of, you know, testing recipes, giving feedback, having the experience. And it is it's a very labor-intensive operation to do it right. And I
do it by yourself, which you did, Kathy.
Yeah, and I really appreciate what single authors have to do.
I have testers who are primarily passionate cook friends, and I say, take this home. Don't ask me any questions right now. Read it as if it's a book. The third element of a really good cookbook, passion, voice. But if those recipes don't work, it doesn't matter how pretty the pictures are. It doesn't matter how gorgeous the cover is. It's a useless work.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of your cookbook sales, although some people manage to
overcome
that.
Well, it takes them a while to figure it out, but word spreads. Yeah. It's like, hey, I tried 10 recipes from that book and nothing came out. It's like useless.
Yeah.
And especially if that's what, in my case, I develop recipes for a living for other people.
Right.
So you know that people are really going to be looking at yours and making sure that they work. But I want to speak to what Catherine said about the financial side of it, too. Mm-hmm. I had lunch with my publisher while I was here in New York. And we were laughing about, he has a book coming out of a lady who's doing a salad book. And I was like, a salad book? I have thousands of dollars in pork tied up in the testing of my book. Mm-hmm. And she's going out in the backyard and, you know, with her scissors and cutting
leaves.
Dandelion greens.
Hey, I wrote a cookbook on caviar, foie gras, and truffles.
Okay, you got
top
me top.
That.
Okay,
top
I'm
that.
Like,
top
you know.
It. You got me top.
It was an awesome year, but it actually, you know, I was like, I'm not making any money on this,
not
but I'm having a great time.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I can imagine. That's some fine eating there, girls. Absolutely. It doesn't get any better. So what do you see are the biggest trends right now in food and cooking? Like, where's, you know, the cookbook industry goes through certain sort of evolutions. Do you see, I mean, like a whole hog cookbook, for instance, to
pork's
me
definitely
seems
trending.
Pork is really trending.
God.
What else do you think is trending? The seasonal thing is trending for sure.
I mean,
sure.
Those buzzwords seem so old at this point, but they're very much alive. The local, the seasonal, the regional, we've been talking these words over and over for probably close to a decade now, but I feel like it's not just a trend, that it's become part of people's everyday eating, and it's become real, as opposed to trends that are just, you know, it's not the leopard miniskirt. It's a form of the black dress, right? I mean, there's trends, and then there's real life.
Yeah. Because I'm seeing this like now in magazines and stuff, whereas before it was sort of like the cool people knew about it, but now it's these words are going into mainstream magazines.
For God's sakes, it's fast food. It's,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, that's the biggest problem, is I feel like it is a trend, and it is becoming accepted and sort of an aesthetic, but it's also being co-opted, which is very, you know, when a chain restaurant is doing an artisanal pizza, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything anymore.
It's true.
But you know, I think the biggest trend also is just really economy, which whole hog mm-hmm. and cooking seasonally really address, and also health. I mean, people are struggling with health one way or the other, trying to figure out either how to be healthier and also how to say, screw it, I don't care, I am going to eat as ridiculously as I possibly can, and in reaction to, you know, any kind of health dictum. So I feel like there's this conflict of both, I want to be healthy, I want to eat better, and I also want to go to NASCAR and have a ridiculous funnel cake. No, at NASCAR, they're now serving a funnel cake with bacon and chocolate on top of it.
Oh, right. Oh. I think what Catherine says is huge. There is this schism.
I love that.
Yeah. I'm not there.
Yeah. Oh,
although
I'm totally
I did a cooking class last night, and we made this gorgeous chocolate tart with an amaretti cookie crust and Maine sea salt on top, and someone said, this needs bacon. And I'm like, oh man, we have really lost it.
Jack and I just did a food drop about bacon. One of the guys that we work with down in Virginia, Sam Edwards, he gave us a whole clip on, there's a guy who makes donuts in his hometown that does a chocolate and peanut and bacon dusted donut, and then there was somebody else who was doing a cake with bacon, and then there's of course bacon ice cream, which I've had and which is absolutely
delicious. Apple pie.
Oh, that was right. Apple pie. The crust that voice was laced. Oh, God. The strips of crust were interspersed with strips of bacon. Mm-hmm. So you'd have like, it was a weave. Mm-hmm. So one side would be, you know, the warp would be bacon and the weft would be pastry.
And awesome. And I would say it's in that, it also, that sort of bacon everywhere or chocolate or... It's that irreverency and also entertainment and fun and playfulness that yes. people want to have. I feel like one thing that is great is, you know, that this set sort of seriousness of about food is kind of being poked at a little bit. We can have more fun with it than
what
just
I think the bacon thing is
worshiping
about.
At the yeah, altar yeah. of like yeah. serious food.
I think there's this craving for flavor. Right? They're all, it's like we have the devil and the angel on our shoulder. It's like, be healthy, be healthy, be healthy. I want something real. I want something that has full flavor. And when I cook, I try to like use the best ingredients possible so that you get a flavor blast and you don't have to overeat and you don't have to feel disgusting. Does that mean I don't use butter? No. It means I'm interested in flavor because like it's about balance, I think. And that's what I think the bacon thing is about. Bacon is about pure flavor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Salt, absolutely. Meat, crunch. And what could fat. Be more satisfying? And fat, exactly. You know, that's a lot better than cottage cheese.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I love cottage cheese.
Yeah, but they're put together. Little crumbled bacon on your cottage cheese. Right. Cottage cheese makes me think of my mother and her dieting friends.
Yeah. Well, let's take a very short break and come right back with segment 3 of Straight No Chaser, and we'll talk a little more about radio and TV. We're back on Straight No Chaser. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. In the studio with me is Libby Summers, the author of The Whole Hog Cookbook, Kathy Gunst, who has also a new book, Notes from a Maine Kitchen, and Catherine Alford, Test Kitchen Director at Food Network. So let's jump over and talk a little bit about media, since media has been so important in sort of driving general population interest in food, where food comes from, what we eat, and all that kind of stuff. Radio and television, what do you think are the differences in how people respond to content? For instance, Kathy, you do a segment on Here and Now on WBUR called The Resident Chef. And you often, as you discuss, I think you did a panel with me. That's how we
I
met,
did.
Actually.
That's exactly right.
About food talk radio, and you actually cook on air to kind of create, to build in some of the more sensory qualities that go along with food because you don't have the visuals. Whereas at Food Network, and what you do, Libby, also with Paula Deen and with other authors that you work with, is very visually oriented. So how do you think those play out differently in terms of the way people absorb information about food? Do you think that, I mean, is it words that work or pictures that work?
Well, both. I think people crave the pictures and they've become really dependent on them. The thing about talking about food on the radio is it's very much, as we're doing right now, it's about storytelling as opposed to saying, oh my God, look at that picture of that pork dish, you know, or look at those gorgeous kitchens at the Food Network and that beautiful cake. It's my job to kind of build the visual so that you're home, you're doing what you're doing, you're driving in traffic, you're at your job, but you're hearing a picture of a dish, and hopefully you can picture it and almost taste it. So the words become very important, as you said, because obviously you don't have the visual. And it's a challenge, but it's a great challenge.
And what kind of topics do you typically cover on your segments? Do you do recipes or do you talk about food trends and sort of
any both? And everything. I used to cook live before all the wars and the world just exploded. I used to actually cook live on air. So we never boiled pasta because there's not very interesting sound.
Right.
But it's kind of interesting. Chopping a raw parsnip has a very distinct sound as opposed to, let's say, shaving fresh ginger has another more subtle sound. So you become very attuned to this sense in food, which is very overlooked. I once interviewed Jacques Pepin, and he said he could walk into his kitchens and tell if his chefs had overcooked the steak based on the sound of the sizzle he heard.
Absolutely.
This is not how chefs are trained. It's really fascinating. So I'm really interested in sound and food.
Yeah, absolutely. And for you two who both work in the visual world, how do you think people, do they respond to the word, you know, the verbal part of the broadcasts as much as they do to the photographs or the you know, the footage?
I think the medium totally changes how people interact with it. We're talking about radio, television. I spend a tremendous amount of time working on Food Network magazine, which is very visible, very, very visual. And there very is very little text about the food. The image really relates it, but there's a very different relationship for the user depending on the medium. So, like, for example, the magazine is very, very recipe intense. And so people really use it to take it into the kitchen or to vicariously have that food experience. On television, it's very much like radio. They want story, conflict. It's, you know, beginning, middle, and end. Where's the tension? That's why a lot of the competition shows really resonate on our network and in others. But then also then the internet gives a whole nother. There are things you can talk about in a website that you can't talk about on television very successfully on radio. For example, not to harp on health, but that has a life online that it doesn't have in other medium, because it's not very sexy to watch a television show about health, but people, we see it over and over from the searches that people are looking for and page views. Healthy content has a real vibrant life online and in blogs and sort of in the mommy blog world and people struggling to how to feed their family. And so the medium allows you, and I think all these different choices is kind of interesting, because then all the different voices do have a place to live, and it's not just one medium that we're interacting with food.
Right, and people are taking it in on every level. Unfortunately, we only have a couple minutes left. I have one more question that we're going to be allowed to do here before we wrap it up. And this is something that I have had many conversations with. I'm going to jump right into this. Should cooking be taught in schools again the way it was when we were kids, or do you think that people will never cook the way they did when our parents were growing up?
100% yes.
Yes.
Yes, but not the way we were taught.
Yeah.
But and I also, I have to say, I think that the food in school movement is fantastic. I wish it was less chef-driven and just like about, this is a life skill that anyone should have. You don't have to wear a chef's jacket in order
to
do it.
I'm not a chef, and I'm teaching in South Berwick, Maine. We've built a hoop house. I taught 460 kids cooking classes last year. It's happening big time.
And the kids respond well. How about down south where you are? Do you see a big movement towards that? It's very popular here in the Northeast. I don't know how it's playing.
It is not in the
regional
area that I am.
Really?
A little bit further south, there's some great things happening in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly not. I just made a face.
I loved that.
I just made a
face.
She gagged.
Love this woman.
So I wish it was more in Georgia. I completely agree with these wonderful women that it's about the growing as well as the teaching of what's happening. It's how to grow these wonderful things. And, you know, once they grow it, they'll be more inclined to use it.
They don't say no after they've grown
no,
it.
No. There's a lot of work that goes into it.
That's true. You know, my take, of course, I think I've been saying this for years, that if, you know, when we stop teaching people how to cook in school, or at least exposing them to the idea that taking a can of tomatoes and boiling up a pot of pasta is just as good as opening a jar of ragu, maybe better, certainly a lot cheaper.
Right.
You know, that sort of home ec aspect of it really just went right out the window. And now that's why people are so like, well, it's so much cheaper to eat in fast food restaurants than it is to cook a meal at home. That is actually not true.
Yeah, I think that the economy issue is something that really is driving people. We can't, you know, you talk about trends. Like, cooking is much cheaper. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got first graders growing kale in a hoop house in Maine, and then we're making chips from them, and they're going home and saying, Mommy, I want kale. I don't want those potato chips anymore. I'm not making this up. Like, this really happens.
Wow.
So,
that's
I just
very
love
inspiring.
Every time Kathy says hoop house.
Me too.
Like, can you say that like 10 more times?
I'm trying to figure out. As an urban gal, I'm like, what is that?
We're going to go out and have lunch now, and you can say it like 25 times. Unfortunately, our time is up, ladies. Thank you very much. Libby Summers, your book is The Whole Hog Cookbook. Thank you so much for joining us at the last minute here.
Oh my
I really
gosh,
appreciate it.
What a pleasure.
Good sport there.
I love meeting
Catherine,
you.
Thanks a million for coming out and giving us the Food Network Spectrum. And Kathy Gunst, Notes from a Maine Kitchen. These books are both on sale now, wherever books are sold.
Thank you.
Please Katie. Join us again next week when we talk about hydrofracking on Straight No Chaser.
Congratulations on the first show.
Thanks,
yay,
honey.
Congratulations. Yay.
Congratulations.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Own seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Field to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com.